Hi, salesman. This is Jack Lacey. I am very proud and happy to bring you this record by my good friend Red Motley. I am sure it will stimulate and enthuse you, add to your selling power, and help you increase your income. This speech, "Nothing Happens Until Somebody Sells Something," was made by Red in Richmond, Virginia, to an audience of 2,000 salesmen while we were on a barnstorming trip together through the South. Red is one of the greatest salesmen I have ever known. He is also one of the most dedicated men in his devotion and efforts to make the world a better place for us salesmen to live in. I have watched and studied Red for more than 30 years. I have had the opportunity to work with him on scores of programs. Among others, we put on the first of the big sales rallies before one of the largest groups of salesmen ever assembled. There were more than 8,000 salesmen in the audience. We also conducted a rally together in Carnegie Hall. I think this is the first and the only time that salesmen ever spoke on the platform of that great institution. Red always fills us salesmen with enthusiasm and makes us tremendously proud of the fact that we are salesmen. I am sure that this record will do the same for you. Red was the first man ever to receive the Oscar from the National Sales Executives as America's Outstanding Salesman. When Red talks to you about selling, he is not reporting something that he has seen somebody do. He is telling you things that he has actually done himself. He is a very great salesman with the unusual ability of being able to pass his ideas and enthusiasm on to you and others. When I first met Red, he was a young advertising salesman in the Middle West. This was about 1930. Over the years, I have watched his tremendous progress. I saw Red take over Parade magazine when it was a small, struggling paper in the advertising field with a circulation of 1,800,000 and advertising sales of $2 million a year. Red made it great. Today, Parade has a circulation of more than 10 million. And sales of over $25 million a year. He made it a leader among all the publications in the advertising field. You will be informed, inspired, and enthused by this great talk by this great salesman. I am very proud that I can bring to you this record by this great crusader for the betterment of salesmen everywhere. Here he is, our very good friend, Red Motley.
I was delighted to come down here tonight with Jack Lacey. Last night we were in Norfolk. Tomorrow night we're going to be in Greensboro. And Thursday night we're going to be in Winston-Salem. Jack and I are here because we believe that what you and we do for a living is important. And I'm delighted to come down here with Jack and talk to you men and women. I'm delighted because I believe that anybody in selling or distribution ought to be willing to plow back a little of his own time and his own money into the activities of our profession, the profession of selling. I didn't come down here to make a speech tonight. I came down here to sell an idea. Like Lacey, I have been selling for 30 years. And like Jack, I like what I've been doing. And because I like what I've been doing, it appears to have liked me. It's an idea that I've been talking about for 20 years. And God willing, I'll talk about it for 20 more. I accept the fact that we're all human. And in spite of the fact that we are told something, we don't always remember it. And it's well to be reminded of it. And so I'm going to try and sell you an idea, give you a little advice, which I hope will improve your operation and improve the money in the commission check or the paycheck at the end of the week. The title of my talk tonight is "Nothing Happens Until Somebody Sells Something." Nothing happens until somebody sells something. The first thing I want to sell you men and women tonight is basic and fundamental. Unless you and I, those of us engaged in selling, retail and wholesale, printed and personal, understand what we do and understand it in terms of benefit to others than ourselves, we will never do it well. We will always be vulnerable. The first thing any man who is going to realize on the great potential or capabilities he has in selling, the first thing he's got to do is to understand what he's doing. Why selling? Let me see if I can make that crystal clear and give you a better understanding of what you do. A lot of people talk about filling needs. A lot of people think of us ourselves in terms of filling needs. Skip it. Not so. We haven't been a needy people for 50 years in this country. We're a prosperous people. We're not a needy people. We're not engaged in filling needs. We're engaged in something far more important than that. We're engaged in making people want things. We're want creators, not need fillers. Think of yourselves in terms of the most important people in America. Because this want creating process, which we as salespeople understand, is the fundamental motivating power behind all progress in all fields. My grandmother died at age 85 in the city of Minneapolis. She never owned a vacuum cleaner in her life, but her floor was so clean you could eat off it. My mother owned a vacuum cleaner, not because she was smarter than her mother or because the Motleys had any money, because we didn't. She owned that vacuum cleaner because a lot of salespeople rang that doorbell out on Pleasant Avenue so many times, pushed their way through that screen door so often, demonstrated that rig so effectively that Mama got to wanting that thing so badly that she put the arm on the old man to get the down payment up, and she kept it there till he made every payment so they didn't take that rig away from her. That's how we've got more vacuum cleaners than all the rest of the world combined. Not because a man in Ohio invented the vacuum cleaner. He did. Funny thing, though, he went broke. Flat broke. Here was a better way for keeping floors clean. Lord knows the housewives of America needed it. But they didn't want it. And he went broke. And he took his invention to a fellow by the name of Hoover. And Hoover, doggone, nearly went broke. Why? Because he couldn't get any department stores or retail stores to handle it. Because they said, quite properly, nobody wants it. There's no demand for it. Why should we give it any floor space? And so he had to go out and devise his own method of distribution. And he developed a door-to-door selling technique. Today, every department store, specialty shop, handles vacuum cleaners. And why? Why, because a lot of people want them. That's why. We've got more automobiles than all the rest of the world combined. Not because we need them, but because a great automobile industry made our people want to go someplace sitting down. That's right. And they made them want it so badly that even during the last Great Depression, they would face almost eviction from their homes rather than miss a payment on the old jalopy and run the risk of repossession. And what happened? Hundreds of thousands of good jobs in Detroit and other cities manufacturing automobiles and parts, and in the oil business and in the gasoline business and in the garage business and in the service business. That's the reason why we've got more good jobs than all the rest of the world combined. Let's understand that. Let's have done with all this nonsense about America having some particular patent on inventive genius or some particular excess of natural resources. The only thing in the world we've got is the greatest thing in the world. We've developed the power to make people want things they don't need. I've been married to the first and only Mrs. Monty for 22 years. And up to 2 years ago, I thought those first 20 years had been wonderful, every one of them. But 2 years ago, I began to wonder how we ever got through those first 20 years because we didn't have a mink coat. I really began to worry about that. I really did. Little Jerry got to wanting a mink coat 2 years ago so badly that it was no longer a luxury, it was an absolute necessity. And I was lucky to get off buying her just the top half a jacket. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with that? What's wrong with Harper's and Vogue, those beautiful style magazines that dress up those gals in those beautiful furs so that they look at them and drool and they want them? What's wrong with a great department store like Miller & Rose right here in Richmond putting those mannequins in the window dressed in furs and then running ads in the Richmond paper saying, come on, girls, make the down payment in August, and by January you'll have enough down on it, you can take it out and wear it while you pay for it the next 10 years. What's wrong with that? How else did we build 60 million good jobs? Some of them in trapping and processing and lining manufacturers and sewing and distribution and servicing and storage. How else? You're engaged in the most fundamental process in the world. Let's understand that process. It operates not alone in creature comforts. In the field of commerce, it operates in every field. You and I know that kids need an education. And what have we done? Why, we've built great educational factories like this one we're in here tonight, all over the land, even out in the rural areas, the great consolidated schools. We run buses into the far remote rural areas to bring the kids into the consolidated schools because we know the kid needs an education. But we're also smart enough to know that no kid ever got an education unless he wanted it, unless some enlightened parent or teacher sold him the idea of getting in and digging for an education. There isn't a man or a woman in this room tonight, but what would agree with me that the principles of Jesus Christ are needed in the world as never before in the whole Christian era. And because we know they're needed, we've built great educational factories in every town and hamlet in America, cathedrals, synagogues, and churches. And we've staffed them with fine production people, ministers, rabbis, and priests. And we've given them the greatest products in history. Three great creeds, Catholic, Protestant, and Jew, refined over the centuries. And what are we worrying about? Why, we're worrying because the pews are half empty on Sunday. And there's juvenile delinquency in some of the parishes. The need is there. What's wrong? Why, the church has forgotten in too many instances that a sanctimonious demeanor, a deep bass voice, or a turned around collar is not enough. In the days when the church was vigorous and growing and militant, the great preachers were great salesmen. They didn't sit on their fanny in the store or the factory waiting for the customer to come in and take it off them. They went on foot and horseback, even back to Galilee, and sold and made converts because needs were never enough. Wants are the only things that matter. And what's the difference between making a woman want a better way of keeping house, or making a child want a better education, or making a citizen want a better moral character? What's the difference? You're engaged in a great work. Lift your sights. Understand what you're doing. Let me close that point by telling a story about my experience. I went to work for a publishing company selling space, Collier's Weekly. They taught me how to sell space. They taught me very well. I got a raise. I got promoted. I got transferred to the Detroit office. And then one day, because Detroit is a Middle Western and a friendly town, one evening the neighbors next door came to call. And I heard Mrs. Motley describe to them how I made the Motley living. Oh, boy. She made the James boys sound like a couple of pikers. She took out a magazine, turned to a four-color refrigerator ad, and said, my husband sells those. The woman said, that's very interesting. My wife said, do you know what they get for them? The woman said, no, I haven't any idea. My wife said, $10,000. The woman said, for how many? My wife said, just one. And the woman fainted. I looked at the thing myself and for the first time realized that I didn't know what I was doing. I knew how to do it. Oh, yes, I did. But I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know why that was important to anybody except the Motleys. I'd heard all this criticism of advertising, consumers research, and all that stuff, and I'd turn up my coat collar like this, hoping nobody would notice me because I had a nice job. It paid very well, thank you, and I didn't want there to be any change. I don't turn up my collar and sneak down the back alleys anymore. And in the 3 years following the discovery I made in 1931, I tripled my income as a salesman because for the first time I understood. I went back and discovered that a man by the name of Kelvin in 1900, the turn of the century, discovered the principle behind mechanical refrigeration. And 25 years later in 1925, in this greatest of all markets, the United States of America, there were three or four little manufacturers, Copeland and Kelvinator, etc., making 75,000 of those mechanical ice boxes, selling them for $500 a piece, and none of them making any money. Then something happened. A couple of big guys, General Electric and General Motors with Frigidaire, got in the business. They did not build a better box, but they did something far more important. They came into Richmond and every other community in America. And they got a distributor, and he set up retailers, and they hired retail salesmen, and they hired showrooms, and they had them put a neon sign outside that said refrigeration, and they used billboards around the town, and they bought space in the local papers to tell the American housewife about this new and better method of preserving food, the protection, the waste, the elimination of spoilage. And in 1931, when this incident took place in Detroit, they're selling 2 million of those boxes. They're now $175, and even the Motleys have been able to afford one. For the first time, I knew that even Motley, this little pimple on the advertising sales fraternity in Detroit, was important. I was a part of something that was big, that was fundamental, that was making jobs and a better way of living for a lot of people. I was doing something that I didn't have to apologize for. And I didn't want my family or kids to apologize either. And so I sat the little woman down, and I told her that story. And when I got all through, she looked me square in the eye and said, "Yep, but what happened to the Iceman?" I didn't know the whole story. What did happen to the Iceman? I don't think there's hardly a man or a woman in this room that knows. And you should, because it's a great American story. They didn't go down to Washington and get somebody to pass a law to keep them in business. They didn't get down and scream and yell to their senator, to their congressman, to the president about the fact there was going to be some employment, unemployment in the ice business if they let these electrical boys take the kitchen market away from them. They did not. They did a typically American thing. They taxed themselves, and none of them were big guys because they were all local operators, for money. And they put a kitty together, and they gave it to the Battelle Institute at Ohio State for research to find out new uses for Iceman's ice. And today, their volume is twice as big as it was when the electrical boys threw them out of the kitchens of America. They created a new want. And in the creation of the new want, they doubled their business and maintained employment and protected the investment that meant a good living for a lot of icemen and their families. That's what I'm talking about, and that's what you're doing. I ask you to understand it. The second thing you've got to do is to believe in what you're doing. Believe. I'll treat this very briefly by telling you my own story. I kept the world safe for democracy in World War I. In St. Paul, a very nice place in which to fight a war. We had no trouble up there, and when I got out of the Boy Scouts in December 1918, the only job I could get was in the iron mines of northern Michigan. I found myself working for the Townsite Mine at Ironwood. The mines up there are closed shaft mines. It was dirty, backbreaking, pick and shovel work, and besides that, I was scared to death every time that bucket went down underground. At the end of about 3 months, one night in the boarding house where I stayed, I met a fat, pink-cheeked, sassy-looking guy with a white shirt on and none of that red stuff under his nails, so I knew he was no miner, and I sat down next to him to see what made him tick. And I found out that he was a zither salesman. The old chick sales lap harp. He bought them for $5 from a wholesale house in Chicago. He never got less than $10 down, so he couldn't lose if he never collected another dime. It seemed like a wonderful idea to me. I threw away the pick and shovel and became a zither salesman forthwith. This was a wonderful machine. You didn't play it with a pick. It had a couple of octaves of keys. You played it like you'd play a piano one-handed. The keys tripped the hammers. The hammers were down, hit the wires, made beautiful music. The mines are going full blast in the spring and summer of 1919. And there's nothing musical up there for those hunkies and their kids except this guy and his zithers. I went like a house afire for 30 days. We gave away 30 sheets of music with every zither. And at the end of 30 days, my first customers came back and wanted more sheet music, and then the cat was out of the bag. The thing only played in the key of C. Right? When you got all through with Smiles and God Save the King, you couldn't do a thing with Dardanelle or Hindustan or any of the hot tunes of the day. Couldn't do a thing with them. No sharps, no flats, just the key of C. I was working to get a stake to get back to the University of Minnesota, and I sold those things right up to September 15th, 1919. Funny thing, though, I never sold as many of them per day or week after I found out it only played in the key of C. If you think you're selling a service or a product that only plays in the key of C, unless you believe implicitly in that product and the promises of the company behind the product, get another job. Because you'll never go to town without belief in what you're doing. Spend a little time on it. Make sure, because in the process of making sure, you'll resell yourself, rededicate yourself. And if your experience is parallel to mine and any other top salesman I know of, you will begin to double your income. And the third thing a good professional salesman has got to think of and remember at all times is the fact that because this is a profession, you're never through. You must have training, but that's not enough. You must have more training. Professional. You heard me use that word. Three things if you're going to be a pro. Understand what you're doing in terms of benefits for others than yourself and your immediate superior. Belief in the product and the company that you represent, and that takes some thought and some figuring. And the acceptance of the fact, like any good professional man accepts the fact that he's never through. That's what I mean by being a professional. And how do you find out whether you're a professional? I'll give you a simple test. How do you act when you're not selling? Let me illustrate what I mean, and watch for this. If you're a professional salesman, you're a salesman 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You don't just put it on when you get the body in front of the prospect and take it off when you leave his office. You don't put it on at 9 and take it off at 5. You're a salesman all the time. You eat, live, drink, sleep, and thrill to the prospect of being a want creator, which is the fundamental motivating force behind all human progress. But how do you know you're a pro? What do you do when you aren't actually selling? Let me tell you my story. This is how I discovered I was a pro.
Please turn the record to side 2.